Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
My name is Laura Goodman. I am an attorney with Margolis Bloom and D'Agostino in Wellesley, and I am one of the co-chairs of the Elder Law and Disability section. I believe my co-chair, Ashley Abishan, is in attendance as well. And if for those of you in attendance, if there are any topics that you are interested in the Elder Law and Disability section putting on, please reach out to me and Ashley with any recommendations, because we want to make sure that we're putting out content that everyone is interested in hearing. And also just a quick plug before we start, for those of you who are members of NALA, the dinner meeting is coming up on March 28th. And so you can refer to the emails for information about that. It's going to be the topic is kind of the alphabet soup of trusts and decoding all of those fun QPERTs and ILIPs and all of those. And they also have the Bring a Buddy feature where if you are not a member of NALA and you're interested in joining, then there is an option for you to attend with a current member. So feel free to reach out to me or to NALA for more information. All right, so today we will be discussing financial planning considerations for our agent clients. This is a topic that comes up frequently in my practice, particularly with older clients who are post-retirement or approaching retirement, and they're thinking about how they're going to plan for this next stage in their life. So how are they going to best utilize the assets that they have acquired? In the case of retirement, how are they going to adjust to changes in income? When do they start taking Social Security and retirement distributions? And what can they afford in terms of assisted living or long-term care if they need it? So I'm not a financial planner and I'm not an expert in senior living placements. So I love to connect my clients with professionals like our panelists, Nora Youssef and Megan Fisher, who can advise them directly, but it's important for estate planners to be well-versed in these topics and be able to ask the right questions and guide our clients to the best possible resources. So that brings us to our panelists today. We are delighted to have Nora Youssef joining us. Nora is a financial advisor and senior vice president of the Empower House Financial Group at RBC Wealth Management. She helps her clients, particularly women, make smarter decisions when it comes to their wealth planning and investments. If she looks familiar, it's because she has presented on personal finance and investments for over 350 organizations. She frequently contributes to TV segments on Channel 5, CBS, NBC Boston, and Yahoo Finance. And just last month, Forbes named Nora a Best in State Top Woman Wealth Advisor. And her team was also recognized as Best in State Wealth Management Team. So congrats to Nora and her team for that well-deserved recognition. We're also delighted to have Megan Fisher with us today. Megan Fisher is the owner and certified senior advisor at Oasis Senior Advisors. She serves the greater Boston area and South Shore, where she also lives. Megan helps elders and their families navigate the senior care and senior living landscape, and she specializes in finding the best fit senior care communities for her clients and also connects clients to resources to help with the transition to new communities or to allow elders to successfully live at home. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our panelists to each speak. After that, we will have more of a Q&A format. I have some questions for the panelists, but if you could please put your questions in the Q&A box, and we'll get to as many as we can at the end of their presentations. So with that, I will pass it on to Nora.
Okay, thank you, Laura. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining. So as Laura mentioned, I'm a financial advisor, often helping predominantly women with their finances and life planning. And because I predominantly work with women, well, the responsibility of caring for their parents and in-laws often falls on their shoulders, or I should say our shoulders. So I walk this ground a lot of caring for elderly parents and helping with their finances. So what I'm going to do in the short time we have here is I'm going to share a story of how I helped a mom and daughter make the most of what they have, understand what they could afford and how to make their money stretch as long as possible. And I'm going to end with my top 10 steps to take when you have elderly parents, so you can be better prepared for what's to come, or at the very least, know what questions to ask. All right, so let's delve right in. And my little case study here involves a Goldie Hawn and Kate Hudson who came in to see me. Now, of course, it wasn't actually them, but to save the confidentiality, protect the innocence, we'll just say it was Goldie Hawn and Kate Hudson. And Kate, being the daughter, Goldie the mom, they came in to see what kind of care their mother could afford. The dad had just recently passed away, Russell. And unbeknownst to the daughter, the mom needed a lot more care than any of the siblings realized. She needed help dressing and bathing. And the husband was a dutiful father and, you know, really never let on the amount of care she needed. So it was clear that the mom needed help, whether it be brought into the home or she go to an assisted living facility for her care. And so they had savings, they had investments, sure, that they had accumulated during their lifetime. And it's not straight math, of course, because there's inflation involved. So it's not a quick back of the envelope calculation exactly. But I did the calculation for them. I worked backwards to see, okay, how much they could afford. And if they were to do nothing else, they could roughly afford about $7,000 of care per month. Now, Goldie was a little bummed to hear that because she had her heart set on Waterstone and Wellesley, which is beautiful. But I always advise never to try out the Ferrari until you know you can afford it. So I said, you know, I don't know if you can afford Waterstone or Wellesley, but I think we could potentially do a little bit better. So here's what I did for them. And again, this could use this as a reference, as this could be applicable to you or to clients of yours. So I first started at a place where most people don't think to start, but I'm going to go there. And that is Social Security. Social Security is very much so an untapped area where I find money for people oftentimes. And a little background, Social Security, usually when I say that, people think, it's peanuts. It is not peanuts. Currently, right now, someone who's 70 years old, the maximum they could be collecting is up to $4,800 a month. That's a lot of money. So I'm going to go over this now, just in general terms. When someone is married, is there any benefit to being married in the context of Social Security? Yes, there is. When you're married, as Goldie was, you can collect based off of your personal earning history or up to half of your spouse's benefit amount. Okay. If someone is divorced, same thing. And I know this area very well. I work with a lot of divorcees. Same thing. You have the exact same right to those benefits, either 100% off of your own earning history or 50% of his or hers, as long as you were married for 10 years, that's the rub, have to be married for 10 years, okay? And in the case here of Goldie, where she was a widow, a new widow, for widows, those rules of Social Security are very generous. And that's because the rules are all the way back from the 1930s, where when a husband didn't come back from war, it was detrimental to the finances of the family. And they really haven't changed the rules, especially when it comes to widows since then. And so for widows, 8 out of 10 times, I'd say I find extra money. And in Goldie's case, we found more money, which was great. For widows, you can, again, collect your own working history or collect up to 100% of what your spouse was collecting. Okay, and you can switch back and forth between the two benefits. So in Goldie's case, Russell hadn't started collecting until he was 70, so she stepped into a really large benefit. Now, these checks don't just magically appear. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. In Goldie's situation, they hadn't, so we proactively contacted Social Security and got things going for her, and that resulted in an extra roughly $2,000 a month. Again, we're talking real money that makes a difference in someone's living expenses when it comes to their long-term care needs. It also comes with an extra $255 lump sum check don't get me started on why they do that and how little it is, but it is what it is. Something else, while we're talking about Social Security, I want to bring up Medicare. There's a nasty acronym called IRMA, which is an income-related Medicare adjustment. Basically, it's a premium you pay if you make a lot of income. And Goldie and Russell were paying that premium for Medicare. Roughly, they were paying an extra $175 a month because Russell had a nice pension, which stopped when he passed away. And there's a lag on this premium, this IRMA premium, that doesn't run off for 2 years. So in 2024, they look at your income in 2022. And so they wouldn't catch the fact that suddenly Goldie was bringing in far less income because she had a deceased spouse, lost that pension. It wouldn't come to for another 2 years if we didn't proactively do something. So what we did, and what I encourage you to do if your mom or dad are in a similar situation, is proactively you apply to a form called the SSA 44 form. I'm happy to help you fill it out. And there are exceptions made, and a death of a spouse is an exception made. So, and you don't even have to wait until a tax return is filed. You just, for in her case, we proved that the pension stopped and we provided the death benefits. And then magically, she saved $175 a month. Okay, so every little bit counts. So we found $2,000 for Social Security. We found $175 savings on Medicare. Yay. What else did we do? Two more areas. One was insurance. So I'm a fan of, you know, using what you have. I don't like adding more bills to people. I'm a fan of using what you have. And in Gold's situation, she had a whole life insurance policy. She wasn't a fan of it necessarily because she said, you know, what's the point of this thing? I'm never going to see the money. She's right. And it turns out, hindsight, it was the wrong kind of insurance because long-term care would have been a lot more useful here. So what we did is I took this old policy of hers and we put it out to bid. Okay. We had the other insurers bid for it. And because we're all living longer, surprisingly, people are interested in these old policies. And what we did is we exchanged from this policy that had a $400,000 death benefit to a new policy that had a $600,000 death benefit. She still was like, okay, great, but still not helping me today. She's right. We were able to remove any annual premiums. It was paid up, so we saved a bill. And most importantly, it was a hybrid. So she could tap into that $600,000 death benefit for her long-term care needs, which she was going to need. Okay. So think of this if you have parents or clients who have these old insurance policies and it's applicable to make this kind of exchange if they're younger than 85 and the cash value within the policy is over $25,000. Okay. So by doing that, we essentially were able to unlock roughly $2,500 a month for her care. Okay. Again, we're really moving the needle here, as you can tell. All right. And the final area we looked at, of course, was the investment. Now, here are three lenses I look through when assessing people's investments. When they come to me with their statements and I just do an analysis and I tell them what I see, here are the three areas I look at that I want you to look at on benefit of your, again, either parents or clients. Or if you are the elder parent, do this for yourself. So one is, Goldie said, oh, you know, Russell always handled the finances, very common, especially in that generation. He always handled the finances. He said we were good. I said, okay, well, let's take a look. And one key is you want to make sure you're diversified. And Goldie said, yeah, we're diversified. We got a couple funds. See, well, I looked under the hood and all of those funds were invested in the same category, which hindsight, Murphy's Law, was the category that's underperformed this past decade. So we certainly wanted to diversify further, okay, to better her chances of better returns over time and take less risk. Secondly, speaking of risk, we want to look at that. We want to assess how risky something is. Obviously, if someone gets older, they want to get more conservative, more protective off of what they have, because they don't have more income coming in to build that nest egg. And nowadays, when I say safety, you really want to pay attention to this. Safety means things like when you're loaning money and collecting interest, okay? So a CD where you loan money to a bank and collect interest, or loan money to a corporation and collect interest through a bond, or loan money to the government and collect interest through a treasury bill. These used to be really boring areas to talk about. In the past couple of years, it's certainly worth taking a look at because interest rates are at 22-year highs. where you can lock in over 5% in this category that, again, is considered the safer category of investing because you're loaning money and collecting interest. You know what you're getting. It stays pretty even keel, and you know the kind of cash flow you're going to be generating versus the stock market, which is where you're owning part of stocks that are going up and down and all around. Okay, so as people get older, they want to have more of the safer type of investment of the bonds and CDs. And in Goldie's case, she had a lot of that in cash. So we certainly put that to work in CDs and bonds. And you can ladder them because, of course, she's going to be needing this money, but we can ladder it. So some comes, you know, the CD and bond come due every year or every couple of years. So she has money available to her, but we're locking in these interest rates. And high yield money markets are not enough. They're good now. They're fine now. You can make interest and the money is accessible. Great. But when, not if, but when interest rates start to go down, it's likely going to start to go down this year and certainly next year, more likely than not, you can kiss that 5% interest goodbye and that nice cash flow for your parents or clients goodbye. So by locking these in now, you're locking in that interest rate even as they go down. Okay. All right. And the third lens I look at, not enough people talk about this, is cost. Okay. So oftentimes there's a lot of ways to invest, and some are much more expensive than others. And that doesn't mean you're getting better returns because it's more expensive. So a lot of what I do is lowering costs and investing in a much cheaper way, a more cost-effective way. In Goldie's case, she had all these very expensive mutual funds and third-party money managers. It all added up to over 2% of an investment cost. 1% is more the standard. So by lowering it to 1%, you think 1%, how much could that actually add up to? On $1 million over 20 years, we're talking about $400,000. It's a lot of money. And it helps the money stretch and it helps allow free up more money to go towards care. All right. So all in all, we were able in her particular case, increase her monthly allocation towards long-term care needs for not just $7,000 a month, but to $13,000 a month. Okay. It's a world of a difference when it comes to level of care. All right. So I'm going to shift gears now. And I'm going to go through that top 10 items that I want you, steps I want you to take for yourself or for your clients, and let them be aware of these things to do for elderly parents. And I'm going to go quickly because we have a limited amount of time. And Megan, of course, is going to come right after me. Okay. So rapid fire here. First item is you want to get organized. For my clients, anyone over 70, gets this family inventory workbook, basically where you organize everything, contacts that are related to your health, finances, and anything legal, passwords, list of assets, medications that you're taking. It's a way to get organized. And if you don't have, or your parents don't have something like this, email me. I'll send you the one I sent to clients. It's a great way, more than anything, to start the conversation with your parents. Use it as an excuse to take inventory and start the conversation of, hey, let's start to get ahead of some things, okay? Two, automate as much as you can for your parents or for your clients. You want to automate their bill pay. That way things don't fall through the cracks. Three, duplicate copies. I love this. For adult children, oftentimes, if the parent agrees, we'll have duplicate copies be sent to the adult child. As just another way to keep an eye on everything, especially with all the fraud that goes on, and also have duplicate copies sent to their accountants. That way they make sure their tax returns get done. How many times have I heard, I'm sure Laura's heard, where someone passes away and it's been 3-4 years since they filed a tax return. Yikes. This is a nice way to avoid it. Four, consolidate accounts. It's going to help with better management of investments, required minimum distributions. You don't want to be doing it from multiple buckets. And you avoid a nightmare where someone is, you, the adult child, is then scrambling to get all of the accounts together. And it's also a good way to make sure and screen that things are titled properly. If your parents have a trust, then everything that isn't retirement account should be in the name, should be titled in the name of that trust. Okay. Five, you want to do a little financial fire drill with the advisor. I do this with clients. You can do it with them as well. Where basically, you know, health changes quickly and you don't want to be doing any deathbed tax planning. You know, the last thing people want to think about is their tax planning when someone is ill and could be passing away. You want to get ahead of it and have a plan. So oftentimes these conversations, for example, if your parents bought Raytheon really cheap and now it's worth a lot of money, well, when they pass away, instead of paying tax on all the profit that was made when they pass away, there's a step up of cost basis. Okay. So that's up to the cost of when they pass away. So there's a lot of tax savings. So in certain cases, it makes sense to switch those low tax basis stocks stocks to the spouse who is not going to pass away first. Okay. Six, consider having limited or full trading authority, basically meaning you as the adult child could step in and have money be pulled out to pay for bills or speak on their behalf or investments. And if you're POA, wonderful, make sure the advisor and banks that they use have that POA on file. Number seven, have yourself as the adult child be listed as a trusted contact for your parents. I can't tell you how many times this has unveiled an elderly person who was in trouble, who fell and was on the ground for hours or days on end. It's just another way to have more eyes and ears on your parents. And that allows the person, either a bank or a broker, to call you if they just notice that, hey, your mom, dad, they haven't called me back. Are they okay? Eight, college funds. 529s are a wonderful way to reallocate money that your parents probably want to go to the grandchildren anyways for college. It's a nice way to remove that money from the estate. You can give five times worth of the gift tax exclusion amount. So five times worth, it's up to $18,000 a year now. So that equates to 90 grand grandma, and then another 90 grand grandpa, equating to 180,000. Both grandma and grandpa could give to a college fund per grandchild, which helps minimize the Massachusetts taxable estate. Okay. And federal taxable estate. Okay. And two more. Roth conversions, nice sweet spot for this is when someone retires before they start receiving the required minimum distributions, which now have kicked out to 75 if you're born after 1960. And the benefit there is you pay less taxes overall, and it helps reduce your taxable income, reducing that, again, that IRMA premium with Medicare. Okay. And lastly, if you're still with me, make sure your parents are speaking to an estate attorney. I can't highlight this enough. It doesn't necessarily mean they need a trust. That doesn't only apply for trust. It applies for maybe they're thinking to gift you the adult child property. That may or may not be a good idea, especially again, when it comes to that step up in cost basis. It may make more sense for you as the adult child to inherit property, not be gifted it, or at least get that POA in place so you can act on their behalf for their finances and legal concerns. And maybe it does pertain to trust, like irrevocable trust of protecting a home so it stays in the family, or getting slats done with the elevated, exemptions expiring at the end of 2025. If you don't know what that means, don't worry, the state attorney will explain it more. If your parents do have a trust, don't just assume that they're all set and an attorney doesn't need to take a look at everything again, because a recent change happened in Massachusetts. The estate tax threshold increased the credit from $1 million to $2 million, which sounds great, but it came with a change that wasn't so great. And that was that the Massachusetts estate tax exemption is not portable any longer between spouses. So it likely means or could mean the trust your parents have or your clients have need to be looked at again by an estate attorney, someone like Laura Goodman, who does this sort of thing for a living. Okay, so I'm going to pause there. I'm, of course, happy to be a resource for you, for any clients of yours. We're going to shift gears here to Megan. So Laura, not sure if you want to transition us.
Sure. Yeah. So I think I do have some questions, but I'm going to save everything for the end. So I'm going to turn it over to Megan, who's going to talk about care options and placement options.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for I enjoyed your case study, Nora, of Goldie. What my job here today is to tell you about the different types of communities that exist for senior care or for senior living when somebody either wants that lifestyle or they need that care options. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of jargon. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page as to what the different types of communities are, what they offer, what they don't offer. I'll talk a little bit about what they cost. It's a wide variety, just like any other housing. Talk a little bit about when to plan for them And at the end, just a little bit about what subsidy programs are available, because the subsidy programs are few and far between. Most of this is private pay, almost all of it. So the first, I'm going to go sort of up the care ladder. The first type of community is a 55 plus community. 55 is the new 40, so a lot of times it's a 62 plus community. There's no care, there's few amenities. It's just like any other apartment complex or housing development, except everybody is over 55. There are no subsidies available unless you're going into senior housing sponsored by the town or the city that you're in. Those typically have a 2 to 4 year wait list. Moving up the ladder, there's the independent living community. It's again, just like the 55 plus community, it's a collection of apartments or maybe there's cottages. But here there's a staff that's dedicated to resident wellness and care. So there's an activities director making sure there's a robust activities program for residents. And there's a resident care director. So somebody's looking out for their welfare. If you're a person who always comes down for dinner at 5 p.m. and you're not there, somebody will go knock on your door and make sure that you're okay, so you're not, you know, lying on the bathroom floor for a couple of days. A lot of these places have pull cords that will alert the staff if there's an emergency. Most independent living communities provide one meal a day, usually dinner. Some provide three, some provide zero, but one is fairly typical. Apartments still have full kitchens. Now, independent living communities are the most complicated or have the most variety of the different types of senior living, because there are two types of financial models and three types of settings. So let's talk about the settings first. Independent living community can be standalone. So all it is independent. It can be part of a CCRC. That's a continuum of care retirement community. There's the independent living neighborhood. There's the assisted living building for folks who are not, who have care needs that can't be accommodated in the independent living section anymore. Often there's a skilled nursing facility or nursing home. The CCRCs, the independent livings in the CCRCs tend to be very vibrant. There's usually a pool, some walking trails. There might be three dining rooms, resident run activity and clubs. These are the places like Brooksby Village, Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham, the Commons in Lincoln, Linden Ponds. The last type of independent living are where independent living apartments are mixed in with assisted living apartments. The nice thing about that is that once you move there, you can just add on care as you need it. It's pretty seamless. The downside is because some residents there have those higher care needs, they tend to be not as vibrant a social atmosphere as the CCRCs or the standalones. Now, so there were two types of financial models, and all three of the settings, well, two of the settings use both of the models. The independent living and assisted living only use the lease-only model. So the lease-only model, you're paying monthly, you sign a lease for a year. It can be broken anytime you want with the proper notice. Sometimes it's 30 days. It's usually 30 days. Sometimes it's 60. And the costs in that, in this area, this is independent living, run from about $4,000 a month up to $10,000 a month. So that's the Ferrari that Nora was talking about. The $4,000 a month is sort of more like the old clunker in your neighbor's yard. The other type of financial model is the buy-in. So a buy-in is a large upfront fee, anywhere from about $200,000 to about $1.5 million. Residents do get a portion of that back when they move out. Typically, it's 90%. Sometimes it's 95%. Sometimes it's 0%. You have to read the contract. In addition to the buy-in doesn't really buy anything. You're not buying a piece of property. There's no deed involved. You're buying the ability to live there. So on top of that, there's monthly fees, but they are less expensive than the lease only. Monthly fees run from about $1,800 a month to $10,000 a month. And that it's kind of like a supercharged HOA. So it covers the grounds, it covers the utilities, it covers the taxes, but it also covers the activities and the resident wellness directors and the meals usually. So good candidates for this type of community. Again, it's very much a lifestyle choice. So someone who chooses a buy-in community is looking for that social atmosphere, sort of that carefree living, don't want to take care of their home anymore. Someone is choosing a community that's independent living and assisted living apartments mixed together. They're somebody who's looking towards the future. So there's somebody who's thinking about, you know, what's going to happen when I do need care. And that brings us to assisted living, which is the next step up the ladder. Assisted living is just like independent living community, except that now you're getting three meals a day. Now there's care involved. So you can get care for your personal care needs, things like getting out of bed in the morning, standing by, taking a shower. For higher care needs, they go as far in Massachusetts. Care needs can be accommodated at end of life. So people who need mechanical lifts to get out of bed into a wheelchair, people who need to be hand fed, that can be accommodated in assisted livings in Massachusetts. The only thing they can't do is what's considered a skilled nursing need. So that would be things like open wounds, injectable medications, ventilators, oxygen tanks that the resident can't take care of themselves, things along those lines. If you are in a old jalopy kind of place with low care needs, you might cost you $4,000 a month. You're in the Ferrari, especially with high care needs, it could be as much as $15,000 or $16,000 a month. Again, this is all private pay. There are a couple of subsidy programs, and I'll talk about those once we get through the last couple of senior living communities. So the next step up is memory care. It's just like traditional assisted living, except it's in a secure environment. And about 30% of folks who are in traditional assisted living have some kind of cognitive impairment. And the staff there are experts in that. They have no problem saying, hey, Barbara, that's the same outfit you wore yesterday. Let's go find you a clean outfit, or here's your medications. What the memory care does really well is for people who are not oriented to time and space. So people who might leave the community and not be able to get back and not even know that they should be trying to get back, that that is their home. So it's still private apartments, still private baths. There's no kitchenettes anymore. Staffing ratio is high because the needs of the residents are so high. The programming is specific to people who have dementia. So the goal is to help slow the progression of the disease, but also to make the folks who are living there successful. So one of the most stressful things for somebody who has dementia is pretending that they know what's going on, pretending that they remember when somebody asked them a yes or no type question. In a memory care community, if the waiter's coming to the table, there'd be a plate with lasagna and a plate with a hamburger, and all the resident has to do is point. They don't have to remember that these letters make up the word of that Italian dish that they really like. So moving to a memory care community can actually be a relief to somebody who has dementia. The transition is often rocky, but once they get there and they realize they can just be who they are and show up where they are, it's really takes a big load off of them emotionally. In this area, memory care community will cost $8,000 to about $16,000 a month. Again, private pay. There's a few communities that have some subsidy programs, but not many. And so if you can't afford it and you can't afford assisted living and you need that kind of help, and then your option is long-term care, which is also known as skilled nursing, also known as the nursing home. This is the option that Medicaid will pay for if you financially qualify. So it's for people who either have a skilled nursing need that cannot be accommodated in assisted living, or for folks who have some kind of personal care needs but can't afford assisted living and can't safely live at home. Skilled nursing home, a nursing home is a medical setting. So the room is a hospital type room, not an apartment. Might be in a hospital bed, might have a roommate. If you're on Medicaid, you will definitely have a roommate. You will share your bathroom, not only with that roommate, but quite probably the folks on the other side of the wall through a connecting bathroom. There'll still be meals and activities, but a nursing home has a very thin profit margin. So the money available for activities is smaller. The money available for food is smaller. So if you're in a decent assisted living, the chef might be getting $25 or $20 a day to feed each resident, you know, $20 for each resident for their meals for the day. In a nursing home, maybe it's $10. So the quality and variety of the food becomes lower. Still costs, if you're private paying, $15,000 to $17,000 a month because it's medical care, which is why most people in a nursing home will be on Medicaid. So how do you pay for all this? It's private pay. You plan well, you get somebody like Nora on board, you plan well, get somebody like Laura involved, you plan well. There are a few programs to help pay. One of them was touched on briefly, that's long-term care insurance. If you are somebody who has been paying for long-term care insurance for a really long time, your policy may have been written before assisted living was invented. And you may go to get your benefits and find that you are not covered. Now, sometimes somebody can battle for you, you can battle, you can become covered. In other cases, when you are covered, there's a 90-day qualifying period. So, and it starts from the day you move in. So your family still has to come up with 3 months of that $10,000 a month plus whatever upfront costs were coming. But the quality of life for someone who has long-term care insurance versus somebody who doesn't is so much better. I really highly recommend long-term care insurance. So public programs that help pay for assisted living, again, nothing helps pay for independent living. But for assisted living, there are two Medicaid programs. One is GAFSI, that's the Group Adult Foster Care. The other is PACE. It is the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. I'll talk about GAFSI first. GAFSI will pay for your stay in assisted living in its entirety, but I have never successfully placed somebody into a GAFSI apartment. Almost no assisted livings have them. And those that do, they want you to come in with 3 years private pay. So you pay for 3 years at, you know, $8,000 a month. When you run out of money, if there's a space open, you can move into a GAFSI apartment. I have had a lot of luck with PACE. So what PACE does is, PACE is a community-based waiver program. The goal is to keep people out of nursing homes. They have a lot of great services if you are living at home. But if you're in an assisted living that partners with PACE, PACE will contribute about $2,000 a month towards your care. So if you're in an assisted living that charges $6,000 a month, PACE is covering two, now your out-of-pocket cost is about $4,000 a month. Of course, you have to have an income below $2,700 a month to apply to be on PACE, but there is no look back. So a savvy attorney can get that set up for you, structure your assets, and you get on PACE just about immediately. Another program that works well for some people is the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program. So the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program provides affordable, below market rate, affordable, sort of below market rates for folks who qualify for the program. You can still have assets and qualify for this program because what they do is they take 0.06% of your asset and add that on to your monthly income, and that is your total monthly income. So you could still have $100,000 in the bank helping to pay for your stay in assisted living. Some assisted livings just have one level. Some have sort of a more tiers. It can knock $1,000 off the cost. It can knock $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 off the cost. But it's very community dependent, and it's very larger town or city dependent. The last one is Veterans Aid in Attendance. So, of course, you have to be a veteran. You do not have to be a disabled veteran. You have to be honorably discharged. You have to have served 90 days active duty, at least one day of which was during wartime. And you have to qualify financially. And the financial qualification, because they look at your income minus your medical expenses, it gets pretty complicated. And there is a three-year look back. But what they provide is about $2,500 to the veteran per month, depending upon the veteran's marital status, or about $1,400 a month to the spouse or widow to be used towards their care. And that could be care at home, or that can be care in an assisted living. And If you're really lucky, you can layer some of these programs together. So if the stars align, the clouds part, the angels are singing, I have actually gotten clients into assisted living on the low-income housing tax credit program with PACE and Veterans Aid in Attendance for under $1,000 a month out of pocket, including their meals and care. Now, care can't be very high, but it doesn't happen a lot, but it can happen. So those are the programs. The last thing, if we have time, Laura, I'll talk a little bit about planning, you know, when to plan for these things. Okay. So for independent living, usually you can move in almost immediately unless you want something like two bed, two bath. There's not a lot of two bedroom apartments around here. I don't know why. The wait list will be about a year. If you want to go to a CCRC, so that continuum care retirement with the bells and whistles, they have wait lists of 2 to 4 years. So that is your horizon. If you need assisted living, you can get in most communities almost immediately. Again, unless you want some bell or whistle, like a two bedroom or a private patio or a designated smoking area. Very few allow smoking, certainly not inside, that's against the law, but outside, very few allow it on the premises. And if you need, if you see long-term care, I tell my clients, if you see a skilled nursing need coming down the road towards you, even if it's 12 or 18 months out, get on the wait list. It doesn't cost anything to be on a wait list. If you want to go to a kind of a ghastly place that nobody would like to be in, you can walk right in. There's almost always a room. But if you want to go to a good place with a good reputation and a pleasant environment, the wait lists are 12 to 18 months. Get on the wait list. They'll call you. They'll say, hey, we have a bed. You say, I'm not ready. You stay where you are on that wait list and they'll just keep going. So to sum it up, long-term care, 12 to 18 months, assisted living almost immediately, unless you've got some need that's hard to fill, independent living anywhere from a year to 4 years waiting, depending upon what you're looking for.
And then how do people find out where there are beds available? Do they go through someone like you? Do they just have to call the facilities they're looking at? Is there a central database?
Yes to all of those. You can call me. I don't really keep track of who's got availability in the nursing homes because there are so many of them and they change all the time. So certainly you can call the admissions director and say, you know, what do you have available? Vance.gov is actually a great website for folks who want information on choosing a nursing home. They have the Medicare rating system of 1 to 5 stars is available on that website. You kind of have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt because it's based off self-reported data. But, you know, a 5 or a 4 star is going to be fine. 2 or 1 star, I would not attend, you know, I would not go there. Really, you can just call. There are a few people who do this kind of search for you. They don't charge a ton of money, usually 50 to 100 bucks an hour, usually takes 4 to 6 hours.
And when you were talking about kind of the range that you might expect to pay for various levels of care, it was a really big range, like some, you know, some anywhere from 4 to 10,000, some cases, you know, 1,800 to 10,000, you know, that's obviously very different budgets that would fit within there. So do you find that it's harder and you're waiting longer to find placements in the more moderate middle of the road budgets?
It hasn't been too bad until recently. But yes, everyone is building luxury assisted and independent living. Very few people are building things that are, you know, in the $5,000-$6,000 range a month. It's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But a lot of the more expensive assisted living comes from the care needs. And if your care needs are that high, they're just that high. You're not going to be able to, you know, shave much off of that.
Right. Okay. So I do have some questions here. And again, if you you can you can continue to send them in the Q&A box. I have a couple here on Social Security, which I think Nora can answer. I don't know if she can answer them, but I'll ask her. And the first one is, how does Social Security work if you have a pension? Or how is it impacted if you have a pension?
Okay, yeah, good question. As Russell had a pension. So here's the rub. It depends if it's a private or public pension. If it's a private pension through, say, again, a GE where you are also paying into FICA during your payroll, you'll also have Social Security and there'll be no reduction. Wonderful. If it's a public pension, let's say the person was a teacher or an officer, then likely there's a reduction with Social Security, but it's not as bad as people think. So let's say in the case of Russell, where he had the pension, for him to receive Social Security, there would be what's called the windfall elimination provision, which says you can't have your cake and eat it too. Basically, the maximum reduction of Social Security that one would encounter is roughly about $500 off of the typical Social Security benefit amount, according to their earning history. Not that bad. And let's say their Social Security benefit amount was only worth $500. The maximum reduction would be 50%. So you would still receive the $250. So it's not as bad as people think. And here's the thing too, if someone has worked and paid into FICA for over 20 years, they start to reduce that reduction. So it's not as painful, roughly by $50 a year. And once you reach the 30-year mark where you paid into FICA while also having your pension, there then is no reduction. So you can have both the public pension and your Social Security benefit amount.
All right. And then another Social Security question here. It says, should everyone wait until age 70 to take Social Security?
Great question. I am a fan of that, obviously. And a lot of people say, well, why do that? Because you get it's an 8% increase every year you wait after your full retirement age. So let's say your full retirement age was 66. You add 4 years of that times eight, that's 132% of what's initially promised to you. So it's a great way to get that guaranteed by the government pay raise. And a lot of people say, well, but if I'm collecting a bigger amount for a shorter period versus a lower amount for a longer period, at what point do those lines intersect? Basically, if your full retirement age is 66, as long as you live past the age of 81, cumulatively, it makes more sense to wait until 70 to collect your benefits.
All right. So we obviously went over some of the pretty staggering costs of long-term care or assisted living. So given that most people really probably can't afford that level of care for an extended period of time, this is a little, might be more rhetorical, but should everyone work as long as possible? Should we never retire?
I would say you can't get your planning done soon enough. Always, work with someone to do your projection. Doing them online is risky because, the inflation factor, any small input could really give you a false sense of reality. It's garbage in, garbage out. So I would say work with someone and I like to call it bulletproofing your life and see how much of a cushion is left over for that long-term care scenario and see how you would fare.
I did want to touch a little bit more on long-term care insurance. You both mentioned it. Nora, you mentioned some of these new hybrid policies. Sorry if that was me and my computer. Some of these hybrid policies they now have. Obviously, we see these clients that have these very old policies that end up being a great resource for them. But we're not seeing people having these types of policies, of course, more recently. So I don't know if maybe Nora, if you could just talk a little bit about typically what these policies cost, what they cover. Are they really going to be covering, the level of care that Megan's describing?
Yeah. The newer ones do. So the newer ones do cover the custodial help or personal care. So assisted living homes, adult daycare, in-home care. So the new ones do. The old ones, a lot of them don't have the verbiage about in-home care. So in that case, you can either exchange, if you're early enough, you can exchange into one that does include that. There's also insurance policies that are called indemnity versus reimbursement. I like indemnity. Reimbursement means you have to constantly prove that you need this help and the money goes to the provider. Indemnity means once you qualify, and you qualify for those two activities of the six daily living, cognitive decline, then you get the check and the check keeps coming to you, no matter how you spend it. So I'm a fan of indemnity. And I like the hybrid because, you know, the great thing of insurance is, yeah, if you need it, it's there. The bad thing is you pay into it and you may never see the money ever again. So I like the hybrids. That way someone will get something. Someone in your family will benefit somehow, some way, whether you use that money for your own personal care, or best case scenario, you don't need to use it for your personal care, and then it's there as a death benefit for either your spouse or your children.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Well, I don't have any other questions, but obviously if there are questions that come up, feel free to reach out to any of us after the fact. And I think this program is being recorded, so it will be available online as well. And so thank you so much, Megan and Nora. That was great. Thanks for sharing. And I think can we have your emails? Oh, yes. Let me put our emails in the chat if I'm able to do that. I don't know if I'm able to do that. So I will chat with the BVA. I think I can only chat with the panelists. So I will connect with the BVA and see if they can send out an email to all the participants with emails for myself, Megan, and Nora. And Nora's is there, nora.yusuf@rbc.com.
Yeah. Okay. And I know we're all very generous with our time and, you know, give complimentary consultations. So by all means, feel free to reach out.
Great. And my services are always free. So, well, free to my clients. So feel free to reach out if you have any questions about senior living.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.